Welcome to RISE, Radio Internet Story Exchange, a weekly public affairs program helping you to ask questions, find answers, and distinguish the truth from the lie. I'm Kelly Romaris. We conclude our series on the end of the age of oil with a look at changes now. Human civilization stands on the threshold of a profound change. The fossil fuel energy regime, which birthed and powered industrialization for about a century and a half, is coming to an end. World oil production is peaking, never to be exceeded again. And we are way behind in doing something to prepare for the inevitable exhaustion of the cheap oil and natural gas that has made possible so many of the things we take for granted. Take plastic, for example. It's made from oil. As you listen to this program on a computer or radio made of plastic, look around you now and notice everything in the room that is made of plastic. Remember your last trip to the grocery store. Maybe you asked for paper instead of plastic at the checkout counter. But what about the items that were put into that paper sack? Fresh meats, fish, and poultry are wrapped in plastic. Likewise, that loaf of bread. Water, milk, orange juice, and soft drinks are bottled in plastic. Bulk purchases such as granola, pasta, tea, and nuts are bagged in plastic. And before you picked your fresh vegetables, you probably pulled the plastic bag off a roll in the produce department. Many of your non-food purchases also came in plastic. Shampoo, hair conditioner, deodorant, dishwashing detergent, liquid fabric softener, a bottle of vitamins or aspirin. You may have paid with a plastic bank card. Chances are you store your leftovers in plastic containers and toss the garbage into a plastic bag. Now consider how the food got to the store in the first place. Plants are grown for your consumption, or for the consumption of the animals you eat, with fertilizers derived from natural gas, which may be in a faster and sharper decline than oil. Crops are grown with pesticides derived from oil and harvested by oil-powered machines. Maybe you buy organic fruits and vegetables from the farmer's market. Even if they were grown with no chemical pesticides and fertilizers and were hand-picked, they arrived at the market in a gas-fueled vehicle. And what about electricity? Made chiefly by coal, oil, and natural gas, electricity is a big part of food processing and storage. Think about a pint of your favorite ice cream. It takes electricity to make it in the ice cream plant, keep it frozen in gas-powered transport to your local store, frozen at the store, and frozen in your refrigerator. Industrially produced ice cream takes more energy to make than we get energy from the many calories it contains. There are ways of being more energy efficient with our food production: growing locally, going organic, learning once again to hand crank ice cream. But if we must grow food locally, what happens to populations living in places where there is little arable land? Japan, for example. If food production declines significantly because there isn't enough energy to produce it the way we've been doing, what does that mean for the world's population? Fossil fuels enabled the population to jump from about 1 billion to over 6 billion since the mid-19th century. How will global population be reduced to fit a lower energy world? By now you're probably thinking, we have to go to alternative fuels. And you're right. But no alternative source of energy is a perfect substitute for oil, and we are very late in implementing alternatives on a large scale. Princeton Professor Emeritus Kenneth DeFays, a petroleum engineer who believes peak oil is upon us, has said, quote, "No initiative put in place starting today can have a substantial effect on the peak production year. No Caspian Sea exploration, no drilling in the South China Sea, no SUV replacements, no renewable energy projects can be brought on at a sufficient rate to avoid a bidding war for the remaining oil. At least, let's hope that the war is waged with cash instead of with nuclear warheads," unquote. Given the way the U.S. government has been behaving, especially since 9/11, cash does not appear to be the weapon of choice. But there are some individuals, corporations, and local government agencies that are moving ahead with oil alternatives that can help us save some of the good things of modern living. Take global communications, for instance. Dan Roberts has been producing the Shortwave Report for 6 years. This is an internet-based program which has been nationally syndicated for 2.5 years and can be heard on 22 radio stations in the United States and Canada. Rise spoke to him about how he produces his program without the services of giant utility PG&E.
Whenever I hear the show, you always sign off saying that this show was produced off the grid in Northern California. What do you mean by that?
I live out in the mountains outside of Willits in Mendocino County, and I don't have PG&E. It's actually available now. When I moved here 25 years ago, there was no PG&E out in this area. What I do is I have, at this point, four solar panels that are 75 watts each, and they collect enough electricity that I store up in batteries that I run my household on solar energy.
What kind of batteries?
Well, actually, they're old, used forklift batteries. They're huge. They're about 2.5 feet tall. They're lead-acid batteries. It's basically the same as what's in a car. It's an automotive-type battery, only these are specialized batteries. But you could use, I used to use just car batteries.
Do you ever anticipate moving to hydrogen fuel cells?
No, I don't. I'm 54 years old. I don't think that the hydrogen fuel cells are going to be at a small scale in the next 20 years myself.
No problems having enough electrical capacity to power your computer?
No, I use a laptop, which is very efficient. All laptops are very efficient. I use real efficient lighting. I've lived off the grid for almost 30 years now, meaning I don't have PG&E when I say off the grid. And in the wintertime, when it's cloudy, quite cloudy up there in the wintertime, last winter I used 9 gallons of gas in a small backup generator to charge my batteries up when I, you know, it was like a week of no sunlight.
You say that a lot of people in your area live off the grid.
Yeah, there's thousands of people living in Mendocino, northern Mendocino and southern Humboldt County that do not use grid electricity. Willits used to be called the solar capital of the world. We used to have the solar energy fair here about 12 or 13 years ago. A lot of the development in solar and alternative energy has happened up here through real goods and solar electric systems, and the people that install alternative energy systems around the planet, a lot of third world countries actually use more solar energy and stuff than the United States does. So the knowledge has been here. The availability and the commonness of seeing solar panels is big here. I wish that people would consider buying one or two solar panels. You can get PG&E to pay for half of them. The state is actually paying for it. And if half the households in California were to stick one or two solar panels on their roofs, there would never be an energy crisis in California unless the government wanted to do a deal with Enron and pretend that there was a shortage. And it's really incredible to me that the general media doesn't bring out this point. One of the stories I've covered ever since I've been doing the shortwave report is the use of solar power in Germany, where they made a deal when the Greens came into power 3 years ago, where a solar panel that cost maybe $400 in this country cost $100 there. In Germany, they now have 15% of their electricity comes from solar, and Germany has way less sunshine than North America, well, than California anyway. So my final statement is, please, if you in any way can think of doing it, please put a solar panel on your roof and let's get away from corporate electricity. You don't need that electricity.
The Shortwave Report can be found at www.outfarpress.com. www.outfarpress.com. It's also carried on www.partytown.com/radio. You are listening to RISE, Radio Internet Story Exchange. I'm Kelia Ramirez. Sunny Arizona is a prime candidate for the development of photovoltaics, solar-generated electricity. In Prescott, Arizona, APS, Arizona Public Service, is building what may be the world's largest solar energy facility. Part of it went online on October 30, 2002. APS spokesperson Damon Gross described the project.
Is the Prescott facility generating power now?
Yes, it is. When this facility came online, we started putting 450 kilowatts of solar-generated electricity into the APS system, which is about enough for 150 to 200 customers.
And when the whole construction is finished, how big will it be, and when do you figure it'll be all done?
Well, the first phase of this project is still to be complete, and that's a total of 1.5 megawatts, which we expect to have complete in March of 2003. Within the next 3 to 5 years, APS plans to expand the capacity of this solar power plant to 5 megawatts, which would provide enough power for about 2,000 homes.
And as I understand it, that will be the world's largest solar facility?
Right. Keeping track of this information is difficult because there may be a lot of projects ongoing and started that people don't know about. But according to information that we've received from the U.S. Department of Energy, the largest existing photovoltaic solar power plant is a 3.3 megawatt facility located in central Italy. So if everything goes according to plan, if ours is 5 megawatts and this is 3.3 megawatts, it's even substantially larger than the largest existing currently.
If I did the math correctly, people would be paying right now about 17.6 cents per kilowatt hour for this. How competitive is that to other forms of energy in Arizona?
Energy in Arizona and in this country, fortunately for us, is a luxury that we can sometimes take for granted. It's very economical for us to produce power through economical means, through nuclear, through coal, and natural gas. Producing it through solar energy typically costs about twice as much through these other means, but it has come down greatly in the last 20 years, and we continue to see it go down.
It takes energy to make energy. How efficient is this facility?
It's, like I said, it's not competitive with some of our coal plants and our nuclear plant that we have, but it does produce energy. It's real energy that people are using as we speak, and it continues to become more competitive as time goes by, as the technology is further developed. One of the things people talk about in Arizona, and they talk to us about, is, you know, we have so much sun and it's free, why aren't we using it more? Well, the sun is free, but the technology to harness that sun's energy is what can be costly, and this work and some of the work the others are doing, we hope to lower the costs and encourage others to develop technology that can help us to that end as well.
Do you know at all about how much of Arizona's energy needs are being met by solar right now?
Well, I'll give you a bit of perspective. Once this solar power plant is complete in 3 to 5 years down the line and we're producing 5 megawatts of energy, it's still going to be an extremely small percentage of what our customers require. Our typical summer peak demand is about 6,000 megawatts. So you can see how 5 megawatts that we don't even have yet fits in with 6,000 megawatts. So you're still talking less than 1% across the board.
But are your customers excited about using this? Are they willing to sign up?
Oh, absolutely. We have a program which helps fund our solar site. It's called Solar Partners. And by that, our customers pay an extra $2.64 for their monthly electric bill to be what we call a solar partner, which means part of their energy comes directly from solar energy. Now, of course, the energy that comes through your power lines into your home really doesn't discriminate. Electricity is electricity, but the people who participate can feel that they are contributing toward the development of solar energy and toward its wider use. We have about 3,000 of these solar partners throughout the state of Arizona, and we actually have a waiting list of customers that want to participate as well.
You seem to be the state's leader in producing solar facilities. You have them in other places?
Yes, we do. In addition to Prescott, we have facilities throughout Arizona in Flagstaff, Tempe, Scottsdale, Gilbert, Yuma, and Glendale. In addition, in Tempe, we have what's called our STAR Center, Solar Test and Research, which is where we test some of the most foremost technologies to harness the sun's energy. It's pretty world-renowned in that we have almost every type of technology imaginable to get that sun's energy, and it's a place where we've learned a lot, and the companies that produce the solar panels have learned a lot as well. It's helping them and helping us produce solar energy more efficiently and deliver that to our customers. We're just, you know, responding to what our customers tell us and what they tell us is they want us to explore renewable methods to produce electricity, and we're doing this and we're doing some other things, and you know, we appreciate our customer support, because without their support, our efforts would be a lot tougher to take on.
A note about nuclear. When people speak favorably about the competitive costs of nuclear power, they are not considering all the costs, including building the plant, transporting the fuel, maintaining the plant, decommissioning it, and especially disposing of the nuclear waste. By the measure of energy return on energy invested, nuclear is a big loser. More information about APS's solar projects can be found at their website, www.aps.com. www.aps.com. Like many forms of alternative energy, solar works great for some things, but not for others. It will provide electricity for your home, but don't expect solar cars anytime soon. In fact, as important as cars and trucks are, especially in the United States, the automotive industry and its friends in Washington are resisting mightily any attempt to improve fuel efficiency under the current oil regime, let alone develop alternative fuel technologies. There are exceptions, of course. Toyota is marketing an electric SUV, the 2002 RAV4, in California, the nation's largest car market. But the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has released statistics showing that average fuel economy has dropped for the third consecutive year. In the 2003 model year, just 33 out of 934 cars, trucks, and vans will get more than 30 miles per gallon. In the 2002 model year, 48 out of 865 models achieved 30 mpg. Fuel economy peaked 15 years ago. Perhaps you have heard of the Corporate Average Fuel Economy, or CAFE, standards. The CAFE standards were set in 1975, when fuel efficiency technology was not as advanced as it is today, and they apply only to a company's entire fleet of cars, trucks, or vans, not to individual models. But in 2002, Congress rejected a proposed increase in the CAFE standards. In California, Governor Gray Davis signed into law a bill aimed at reducing greenhouse gases emitted by vehicles, beginning with model year 2009. So far, the best way to achieve that goal is to make vehicles more fuel efficient. But the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers, a trade association of all major car makers except Honda, is suing to challenge the new law, claiming that it exceeds the state's jurisdiction. And the Bush pseudo-administration plans to join the suit on the side of the car makers. But there's a bright spot in Oakland, California, where AC Transit, a bus company serving much of the San Francisco Bay Area's East Bay region, is taking the lead in a program to demonstrate and evaluate several buses run on hydrogen fuel cells. AC Transit spokesperson Mike Mills says the bus company's general manager, Rick Fernandez, gets the credit for pushing zero-emission technology.
AC Transit's general manager is aggressively interested in getting to a zero-emission bus fleet as quickly as possible. He really is the inspiration behind this agency's aggressive pursuit of zero-emission hydrogen fuel cell technology.
Are the buses actually here yet?
No, we just ordered three buses out of nearly 200 that are on order. Three of those buses will be delivered to manufacturers in Southern California for adaption to hydrogen fuel cell technology as opposed to today's low-emission diesel. The diesel is a lot cleaner than diesel used to be, but it's nowhere nearly as clean as these hydrogen fuel cells will be. We expect delivery of those prototypes with the prototype hydrogen fuel cell bus engines probably in about 2 years.
And how long will it take to get the entire fleet of 200?
Well, the 200 buses that I referenced will actually be here within the next two-year period. But this agency, we're the third largest bus system in the state of California. We operate actually in excess of 800 buses. Our objective, our goal, if you will, is to convert all of those buses to zero emission as quickly as possible. That's probably going to take something like a decade, assuming, of course, that this technology proves viable within the next 2 to 3 years. AC Transit will be operating, we expect, what will be one of the largest fleet-sized tests of hydrogen fuel cell technology in the state, if not in the nation. That's going to happen probably in about 2 years. We expect it's going to be very successful, and as a result, there may be marketplace moves. We certainly hope and expect there will be marketplace moves to make zero-emission technology the bus propulsion technology of the future.
And how are you going to fuel these buses?
Well, as a part of this project, we're expecting to build a major fleet-sized hydrogen fuel cell facility at our East Oakland operating division. As you may know, we're party to opening a much smaller hydrogen fuel cell station at our Richmond division. That's sufficient to produce this zero-emission fuel for automobiles, but not really big enough to support bus fleet activities. We'll be building a larger fueling station to handle the bus fleet. That'll be done in East Oakland. We're expecting that to come online in about a year and a half to 2 years.
And how is the hydrogen fuel going to be manufactured?
I don't think we at this point know the answer to that question, and we wouldn't presume to answer it. We are members of the California Fuel Cell Partnership. So are major players like the energy companies, Chevron, Shell. Those are the people who we expect will be contributing to the manufacture of the fuel. When all of this becomes reality, we expect to be users, just as we are today users of the ultra-low sulfur diesel fuel. We don't manufacture that. We don't really know how it's manufactured. We're glad that it's available, though, to keep our bus fleet running.
How much is it estimated it will cost to convert the bus system to hydrogen?
Oh, I don't think there's a way to answer that question with any specificity today. What we're talking about right now, the buses that we expect to be here in a couple of years, will be virtually handmade prototypes, which means they'll be very expensive. The expectation, of course, is that as they become the standard technology, the marketplace volumes as well as the marketplace pressures will drive the price down to something roughly equivalent to what buses cost today, or maybe a little more, but something that would be manageable not only by the East Bay's bus system, but by bus systems across the country and perhaps someday around the world.
Right, we'd assume that there would be concerns about possible need to have a fare increase because of a more expensive fleet.
No, we're talking about really is capitalization of costs. And that's hard to predict, but that's also a level and a degree of cost that really wouldn't relate directly to bus fares. Bus fares are a part of the formula that pays for operating the buses, that pays for the driver, that pays for the mechanics, that pays for the incidental cost that it takes to actually operate the system. To buy the buses, to buy the engines, to establish the fueling infrastructure that it's going to take to support hydrogen fuel cells, that's really done at a whole different level, and it's in fact a different budget. That's something where we expect the state will kick in, the federal government will kick in, the energy companies across the country will kick in, the manufacturers will kick in. Exactly what those costs are going to be, we don't know yet. But we at AC Transit firmly believe that hydrogen fuel cells have a strong chance of replacing today's internal combustion engine. That's why we're pursuing the project.
According to the background I have here, AC Transit has nearly $14 million in grants for this demonstration program. Who is supplying the grant money?
The grants have been obtained at various levels of government, and the federal government is involved in this. As I mentioned, the state of California and the Fuel Cell Partnership and its supporters are involved. There are regional sources as well. And our general manager, Rick Fernandez, has been very aggressive in the pursuit of support, both in terms of finances and in terms of technology, wherever he can find it.
More information on fuel cells and the bus demonstration program is at the website of the California Fuel Cell Partnership at www.fuelcellpartnership.org. www.fuelcellpartnership.org. You are listening to RISE, Radio Internet Story Exchange. This is the concluding part of our series on V The End of the Age of Oil. I'm Kelia Ramirez. Educating people to what's coming is a major challenge. Most media aren't talking about peak oil. Rather, they're broadcasting Dick Cheney calling for more drilling and more nuclear power. Professor Richard Heinberg, who was featured in our last program, is part of an innovative course of study at New College of California, Santa Rosa. It teaches people how to develop a more ecologically sane culture.
I teach primarily in what we call the core seminar, which is the basic course that everybody in the whole program takes, and it's culture, ecology, and sustainable community. Essentially, it's a year-long weekend, one weekend a month class, in which we spend Saturday sort of dissecting modern industrial civilization and to see what makes it the way it is, how it ticks. And each weekend we look at it through a different lens, from economics to education to food and agriculture to religion and spirituality and so on. And then on Sunday we look at various sustainable alternatives. So if on Saturday, for example, we examined industrial agriculture and its roots and its environmental effects and why it's unsustainable because it relies so much on fossil fuels, and looking at all of the statistics in that regard and the trends and so on. Then on Sunday, we would go to an organic farm and also do some hands-on work with seed saving and composting and so on. So the whole year is really designed to be an overview of industrial society, how it came to be the way it is, and then what are the sustainable alternatives that will take us into the future. That's the course I teach. And in addition to that, there are a number of concentration areas that students can choose to take as electives, but they also really focus their time during the year as well in a particular area like ecological agriculture or environmental arts or consciousness healing and ecology or eco-dwelling. For master's students, we have a new program, which is a green MBA, which focuses on triple bottom line economics. It's not just the financial bottom line, but social and environmental values as well. It's the first green MBA accredited in the country, as far as we're aware, in that program. Students not only focus on counting skills and normal finance, but also on local sustainable enterprises and how to design and run one.
You mentioned a few hands-on courses. How hands-on is the program?
Well, it's hard to say percentages because some of the concentrations are almost entirely hands-on, like the eco-dwelling. Students learn about all of the possibilities in natural home building, from straw bale to cob and light straw clay and everything in between, and do a lot of design work and work together on projects and individually on projects and so on. The core seminars are probably more like 60-40 of 60% theory and 40% hands-on work. But I think the theoretical part of it is pretty important because we want students to come away with an understanding of the nature of the problems that industrial societies face and how those problems arose. Because unless we understand in a pretty deep way what those problems are and where they come from, I think our attempts at solving them will probably be pretty shallow.
You mentioned that you had some students who were, let's say, beyond traditional college age. What kinds of jobs or fields of endeavor are they coming from to take this course of study?
Well, people are coming from all sorts of areas and fields, and some of our students are just coming out of junior college, and others are making life transitions. We have had students who've had careers in corporate America and Silicon Valley and so on, who really want to completely change the direction of their lives and be of more service to society and to the environment. And we have a number of students who are really just full-time activists who want to be more effective in that role within society, and everything in between. And then students typically leave the program with skills that will enable them to work in, well, the nonprofit world, but also to create new businesses or to create new positions that may never have existed before, because our society is sort of poised on this precipice of moving into a new energy regime where really all of the old rules, the economic and social rules, are going to be really disturbed station up for grabs. We're moving into an entirely new era, completely unprecedented. I think our students are probably going to be as well prepared to make their way in that world as anyone, and not only to survive, but to be able to make a difference for others and to also to make a living in such a world, because people who understand the dynamics of the energy transition will be very much in demand.
Anyone talking about being an elementary school teacher?
Oh, yeah, we have many, many teachers. Actually, we have one student in our BA program right now who has been a teacher for many years, but always in alternative schools, and he's a great advocate for alternative education, and he just never bothered to get his BA until now. So he's bringing with him to the student cohort just this immense wealth of knowledge of alternative schools and alternative teaching techniques, and just a joy to have him in the class. That's another really wonderful thing, is the kinds of students that we draw typically bring a lot of knowledge and experience already. So it's not just a matter of a few faculty sort of standing up in front and holding forth and everyone else just sort of trying to absorb as much as they can. It's very much a learning community. And I think we're an alternative school, not just in terms of the content of the material we teach, but also the process of education that we try to adhere to, which is very much one of creating learning communities. And, for example, we don't have any tests or standard grades. We give written evaluations of each student at the end of each semester. Students do a senior thesis, which is an in-depth study that they design themselves, and keep an academic journal. So they're very much in charge of their own learning experience while they're in school.
Anyone interested in applying for the program in Culture, Ecology, and Sustainable Community should visit the New College website at www.newcollege.edu, www.newcollege.edu. Professor Heinberg also publishes a monthly essay called The Muse Letter, which can be found at www.museletteroneword.com, www.museletteroneword.com. There are several good books and websites available with which to study the subjects of fossil fuel depletion and alternative energy, if you are an adult. Teaching the subject to young children is a challenge because of the lack of teaching materials, but today's children are the people who are going to be in charge of the energy regime transition as adults. If it is the job of education to prepare the young for the future, children must be taught that the world is going to be a very different place by the time they reach their parents' current age. One teacher trying to meet this challenge is Derek Vandermolen. He teaches third grade in Halifax, Nova Scotia, in Canada. He has been mining the End of the Age of Oil series for ideas to translate into terms his 8- and 9-year-old students can understand.
When did you get the idea of trying to teach about oil depletion to your class?
The idea came as a result of a magazine article I had read. I guess that would be about 3 months ago now. And I had always thought of these things as I looked around in my daily life. But having read this article, it seemed to kind of make the issue a little more pressing, a little more forefront in my mind.
I've been told that already Canada is starting to show signs of dwindling natural gas supplies, and then on top of that, because of NAFTA, you're sending your gas to us. Is that starting to show up in daily life in Halifax?
At sort of the ordinary citizen level, I don't feel it a whole lot. I guess most recently there was some dispute over natural gas between the province I live in, which is Nova Scotia, and the province next to us, which is New Brunswick. And basically the dispute was whether the natural gas that we have coming to us through Nova Scotia, whether that should be made available first to people here in Canada, or whether it would bypass us and continue on to the United States. And unfortunately, the Nova Scotia government got their way in this dispute, and so the natural gas won't necessarily be sold to Canadian interests first, but will pass forward on to the United States.
So far, no problems with heating fuel?
I know electricity costs are going up here. I'm not sure how that's related to natural gas. My interest in this whole issue, I'm basically sort of learning a lot myself right now as I move forward in this and draw closer to bringing it to my students' attention and exploring that with my students. So there's still a lot that I myself need to learn.
Well, now that's an interesting case. You've got some very young children here. They're the ones who are going to be living in a world 30, 40 years from now that's going to look very different because of oil depletion. But I have a feeling that curriculum materials on the subject for that age group are scarce, if existent at all.
That's very true. I would even go a little further to say that whatever curriculum materials might be out there, and I must be honest to say that I haven't done enough searching just yet, I would venture to say that some of the curriculum material that we do have out there is probably brought to us by virtue of some of the multinational corporations who have interest in oil and natural gas. So far as a more critical position and attitude toward this entire issue, I haven't come across anything yet myself. So a lot of what I foresee doing with my class, a lot of it will be speaking with other teachers who are oriented similarly to myself and trying to scratch some stuff together myself. Although part of my approach with my students is to try and just present issues in such a way that I really begin to learn how they feel about these things, what their knowledge of these problems may be already. Many of them, of course, watch TV at home, and some of them often hear things on the news as their parents watch the evening news. So many of them come to school with some ideas, often vague ideas that need some exploration and clarity. So the classroom is a good space, a good time to discuss these things and share our knowledge of what the problems may be, as well as the kinds of solutions we might invent or bring into our lives. Obviously, there's alternatives to oil, so those would be some of the things that we would discuss. And I recall back in the 70s, when I was their age, I seem to have some memory of hearing a lot about solar energy, and I also remember being somewhat curious about why I didn't hear more about solar energy. It seemed to have got tucked away at a certain point in time, and I didn't hear anything more about that. One would have to dig pretty hard and deeply to find more about those kinds of alternatives. So that's where that's at. One of the things that I hope to do with speaking to my class and seeing what they have to say and what we'll learn from the end of the age of oil, I hope to also link that to other issues, certainly war both around the world, as well as how the kind of police state that seems to be growing here at home, how that may relate to the oil culture that we are highly dependent on. I also hope to bring in other issues such as privatization of water, as well as food safety, and probably some attention given to work as well, unemployment and kinds of work that may be before us in the future. In terms of war, the class I had last year on September 11th, I was the one who informed them of what had happened that day. So in a very real sense, teachers are significant people in these children's lives. They're often helping them along with things that are very real and close to their lives. New York is not that far from Halifax, and some of these children realize that. I had one child last year whose father had actually supposed to have visited the World Trade Center that very week, but that trip had been canceled. So her attention to the issues were fairly heightened, and she was also, she's of Middle East descent, so there's also race involved there. So what I try to do is bring a lot of the information that I find from alternative sources to my kids, hoping that that will balance somewhat the news that they get. Often they bring the points of views or the views, beliefs that they bring in are very mainstream. They have often the seeds of racist perception. So, I do what I can. And sometimes I do get flack back from parents or frowns from my coworkers and so on. But it's something that I feel is important. I think one of the know, things we really have to push for in terms of communication is more open communication, more open sources of information so that people can make more informed decisions in their lives. I think we don't get a lot of that around the issue of the end of oil, and hopefully that will change.
What did you tell them about 9/11, and how did they react that day?
I had been in the office. My students were in gym when we received news of tragic events. When I brought my students back to class, and without getting into any other work that we may have been doing, we sat down together in a circle. And the students I had last year, they ranged in age from 7 up to 10, in fact, so quite a range of ages. And they were quite a motivated group of children, very, very keen in discussing world events. When I talked to them about what had happened, I don't think they really had a strong sense, of course, what that meant or what that would look like. And it wasn't only until the next day that many of them came back talking, just relating to the images they had seen on TV the evening before. The discussions that happened in the few weeks after September 11th, there was talk, of course, of the United States going into Afghanistan not long after. Many of them took sort of the one-sided position of really not thinking of the United States as being in any way questionable in what they were about to do, but seen more or less of a playground scenario where, you know, there's a good guy and a bad guy, and in this case we were the good guy, and so it was fully justified for the United States to go over and do what they had to do. There was no sense whatsoever that there would be people over in Afghanistan who would die and what that would mean. I think in some ways children still have a fairly traditional sense of war as being fought among soldiers and not involving ordinary and innocent civilians. When the U.S. began their bombing of Afghanistan, I tried as much to inform my students of some of the casualties that the Afghani people were experiencing there as well. And, of course, I have also tried to help them become a little more aware of some of the things that the United States does around the world as well in other countries. Nicaragua, for example. And generally, they're pretty receptive to that. Of course, children that age don't come into class with a whole lot of history or sense of history, so they're very open as to what they hear. And of course, as a teacher, I need to be fairly responsible in what I'm telling them and be careful not to sway them one way or another, but to simply bring in information that would help them make some decision on their own. I did receive some flack from one set of parents in particular who felt I was indoctrinating the children. I invited them to attend my class during one of the discussions, but they didn't show.
Do you teach all the subjects to the kids?
I do, except for gym and music. I teach all the other subjects. That gives me some flexibility in terms of the kind of instruction that the students will receive. I'm glad to have that flexibility. Although the school board I'm in, there's a strong emphasis on reading and writing skills, much as you'll find elsewhere in North America right now. So here in Halifax, there's an hour mandated hour of language arts instruction, and this year they've begun with an hour as well for mathematics. And that seems to be cutting into other areas. All the other subjects have to be taught in the remainder of the day, and that doesn't leave a whole lot of time for individual subjects. The school I'm at here, in just outside Halifax, we begin the morning at 8 o'clock, and the students leave at just after 2 o'clock. And there's an hour for lunch and a 15-minute recess period as well. So that leaves us with, as well as with all the walking between areas of the school that we might be doing, that leaves us with a little more than 4 hours, 4.5 hours, let's say, of instructional time. 2 hours, as I was saying, which are allocated to math and language arts. What I tried to do is I tried to introduce a lot of these social justice, environmental issues within the language arts curriculum, and even in math. I think when I teach a unit on oil depletion, the end of oil. It will certainly involve some very basic math skills as well, graphing and so forth.
What are the expectations for teaching environment, ecology, science to that age group in general?
Well, the science program in our school is not very strong at all. What I tend to see, not just in my school either, but other schools, some of the subjects, the extent to which they're taught largely depends upon whether the teacher is able to teach them, both in terms of their skills, as you were just saying, the time they have to teach these things, as well as the whether there's curriculum materials for it. Some of these subjects require, you know, physical materials. Visual art requires paint and pastels and paper and so forth. Science has its own whole set of materials that it requires, as does math, manipulative blocks and so forth. So at our school, there's not a whole lot so far as science is concerned. Hopefully that's something that we'll see next after the school board is through with implementing their new math program. I would probably want to say one thing at this point in terms of environmental science. I rocked the boat last year a bit with my school. Last year, our school was sponsored, or as the phrase is used, adopted by Walmart. Because of the funding cuts we're seeing to education, our school, as with so many other schools around, have to rely more on the business community to fundraise, as well as parent-teacher groups, but parent-teacher groups can only do so much, really. In the area community that I'm in, it's not a very affluent community, and so there is quite a strong reliance on businesses in and around the community. Walmart is one of the larger ones, and so last year our school was one of their adopted schools, and some things came to us through them, some computers and other things, lots of kind of candy that leftovers of one kind or another, you know, got passed on to us, stuff that has nothing to do with education. But the time came in April on Earth Day, International Earth Day. Walmart asked our school if we could do some kind of little event around that. And at the end, it was decided that we would do a cleanup of the school property. Now, this is something that traditionally our school had done in the fall time as a fundraiser in and of itself, and it was school-based. So there was no businesses involved in the fundraiser. We called it a clean-a-thon, and we did our entire school property, and some of the older grades went around the community and cleaned up. But last year that didn't happen, and with the new administration that came in last year, it was a little more business-oriented. And so on Earth Day last year, the students cleaned up just the schoolyard, and at the end of the cleanup, a picture was taken of everyone up on the side of the hill, and a large banner saying Earth Day was spread across the front of the crowd, and the picture went up at the local Walmart. I made a point of expressing my objections to that, and I mean, just the hypocrisy that's involved in, you know, Walmart being environmentally sound, or, you know, such a consumerist box store, just seems very at odds to what they're all about, really. And anyhow, I wasn't part of that picture, and gladly so. I think the administration has sort of has come to know me to be a bit of a, you know, a teacher who stands up for these things, who has one eye on the class and one eye on any of the wider issues affecting us.
What would you want in the way of materials to teach about oil depletion to your class? What are you looking for? How are you thinking of teaching this?
Most immediately, the thing that I would love to have are colleagues who are interested in this. Certainly, you know, having other teachers who are as interested in this or as open to learning about it and bringing it into the classroom. I see that as being probably the most valuable resource. Aside from that, certainly, you know, I use the internet. I'm on the lookout for guidebooks, things like that. Certainly the show that you've provided has been invaluable. It's a show that I can make notes from and try to bring in down to a level that students will understand. In terms of how I plan to go about this, there would be some graphing of information and facts, so there'd be data that's brought in. And rather than my suggesting to the class what the implications are of the facts that are out there, I would want to hear what they're thinking those consequences might be. I've got one idea for an activity, and it's something that would probably happen over the period of a week. In our school, because of the budget cuts we've had here, we've lost a few teachers, and that's opened up some storage space. It's sad in a way, of course, but there it is. And I think what I may do is, for a week, pack away everything in our class that is derived from oil. So that would include all the chairs that the kids sit on. That would include all the blocks that they use in math. That would include probably some of the art materials. That would include some of the books we have. That would include the computers we have, of course, as plastics and those, for example. When the kids bring in things from home, such as their lunches and school bags and the clothes they wear, we would discuss those things. But I find that kids, for them to bring values and knowledge that they've created forward in their lives, it has to have a fairly strong impact when it's presented to them. So I think something like that would have a lasting effect.
So you're looking for a more experiential approach for them?
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. I'd rather see them fully participating in this learning and the knowledge that's created, as opposed to it being more a spectacle, something that they're just looking at with their eyes. So it's something that I think they need to feel fully in their bodies what that would look like. As I was just out earlier today, driving to the grocery store and doing my groceries and just looking around at what our lives look like, and being fully aware that it doesn't have to be like this, and nor will it one day, and not too far off into the future either. So it's hard to imagine, because it's such a profound reliance we have on this resource, how different our lives will be. I mean, I already live fairly frugally, but were I to live like, let's say, the rest of my family, I can't imagine the changes I would experience in going from living a lifestyle that's, as it is, dependent on oil and other things that we take for granted as well, to one where those things are just not available to us.
Do you anticipate some sort of final project for them?
That's a very good question. In fact, what I'm trying to do is, we have a program here in Canada called Grassroots, and it's a federally funded program, and it's administered by each of the provinces and territories. And I will probably use the end of oil as one part of a proposal to this program, and the program provides some monies to the project if it's accepted. And the program is set up basically to encourage the learning and use of computer skills and so forth. So I'm hoping that what we do in class will become part of this project, which will end up as a website or part of our class website. It would probably include some digital video and PowerPoint and other kinds of things as well. The money that we receive from this, I hope to turn back into the interest of working toward alternatives. So that's where that's at. I hope there's teachers out there who are up and doing these sorts of things. It's very important. It seems to me that, you know, aside from activists and some people in the progressive communities, there's a lot of the people who seem to have control and political influence at more executive levels. They don't seem to be bringing this to us, and it's not something that I think we can wait around for them to bring to us. I don't think it's something that it's in their interest to do. So it's really something we have to do at a grassroots level, and I just hope that there's many of us out there doing that in our everyday lives.
Any teachers who are interested in creating an oil depletion curriculum for elementary school children can contact Derek at the following email address, dvander@staff.ednet.ns.ca. That's dvander@staff.ednet.ns.ca. And now for a little editorial. I am convinced that people occupying the highest levels of the U.S. government knew the 9/11 attacks were going to occur and let them happen. If you don't believe me, visit www.copvcia.com. That's copvcia.com. They let them happen for a number of reasons, not the least of which was oil. They needed something dramatic to get Americans behind a war for oil, and the only way to do it was to get us outraged and petrified about Middle East terrorists who, quote, hate our freedom, unquote. In the wake of the attacks, they are solving the hate our freedom problem by destroying our freedom with legal abominations like the Patriot Act. And they have vowed to wage a war that may not end in our lifetimes, according to Dick Cheney, who I believe is the real power in the Bush pseudo-administration. It is in large part a war to break up OPEC and exert Western domination over the oil and gas fields in the Middle East and Central Asia. These fields will peak last as global production declines. But peak they will. Oil and natural gas are finite resources. War is not an energy policy. It is only the source of death and misery for millions. Is this the way we will reduce global population to the levels the Earth can sustain after the end of the age of oil? You have been listening to Rise, Radio Internet Story Exchange, a weekly public affairs program helping you to ask questions, find answers, and distinguish the truth from the lie. This has been the last part in our series on the end of the age of oil. Previous programs in this series featured Michael C. Rupert on 9/11, oil, and war, Dr. Colin J. Campbell on peak oil, Jeremy Rifkin and Dale Allen Pfeiffer on the oil alternatives, and Professor Richard Heinberg on changes to come. Radio Internet Story Exchange is produced by myself, Kelly Ramaris, in part at the studios of radio station KPFA 94.1 FM in Berkeley, California. The website for RISE is www.riseforNews.net. That's RISE, the number 4, news.net. RISE programs are available on demand at the RISE website, and are webcast on the news stream of Partytown Streaming Network, www.partytown.com/radio. Radio Internet Story Exchange receives no corporate or foundation funding and depends on you for support. For more information on donating to RISE, receiving or publicizing the program, or giving feedback on programs, please email kellia@riseFornews.net. That's K-E-L-L-I-A at RISE, the number 4, news. This has been RISE, Radio Internet Story Exchange. Thanks for listening.